3 years.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who's sponsoring the letter of intent?
Nobody is.
There's no sponsor of that. I just passed that around, and I thought there may be some other testimony which would indicate a desire for it. Representative Pichot, just because we passed the letter of intent here doesn't mean that we have to bring it to the floor, but this is just a concern that I heard expressed, that that there's certainly no directive to the governor as far as how it's going to how he might make his appointments, and he could change it, and this is just a concern that I heard expressed. But if it's not the desire of this committee, I'm certainly not going to bring it.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we report out with individual recommendations House Bill 424.
Is there any objection to reporting out House Bill 424? If not, the bill moves from committee with individual recommendations. The next bill before us is House Bill 323, Representative Swackhammer. And if we could go back to our mics, there is somebody apparently on teleconference for this bill. Representative Swackhammer, did you care to have a few remarks on House Bill 323?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll make my remarks real brief. Basically, 323 is an attempt to accomplish two things. Number one is to try to get the testimony of small children when involved in sexual abuse cases to a point that where they can reasonably communicate. And number two is to try to de-traumatize the victim during the testimony procedures. There's been a considerable amount of work that's been done on this bill in judiciary, and I think that you will hear from the Department of Law, from the Public Defender, and from the Office of Public Advocacy, and let them speak for themselves.
Were there any questions of the bill sponsor before we go to public testimony? If not, there are several people signed up. If we could go to our teleconference people first. Do we have Jay McCarthy online?
This is Mr. McCarthy.
Please proceed, Mr. McCarthy.
I apologize. Am I talking loud enough to be heard?
Yes.
I'm a staff attorney with the Office of Public Advocacy, and designated as the deputy public advocate in the civil section. And we are very supportive of Representative Swackhammer's bill. Our analysis of this bill from a fiscal point of view will lead us to submit a fiscal note which will have a zero impact on budget increase for us. What I would like to point out to the committee is that one of the most significant parts of the bill is that it gives the child a voice in the criminal proceeding through a guardian ad litem. In most cases that where this bill would address the testimony of a child, they are usually sexual abuse or physical abuse cases. And generally speaking, there is majority of these cases a guardian ad litem appointed in a parallel child in need of aid proceeding. Because of that, we do not see at this point a significant increase in our caseload. The bill also would allow in those cases such as a murder or a violent assault or a kidnapping where a child is a victim or a witness, the potential for a guardian ad litem to be appointed by the court if there is already not one appointed in a parallel proceeding such as a child need of aid proceeding. So that may result in some new cases. We do not believe there will be a significant increase in our office to justify submitting a fiscal note. The reason we say that is we do have from time to time cases that come through our office in the form of a child need of aid case, which are the result of a child being placed in state custody due to the possible murder of one of the spouses by the other spouse. So for that reason, at this time, we are in support of the bill, and we are submitting a fiscal note in the future for this bill. If any of the panel committee have questions, I will attempt to answer them at this time.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Are there questions? Thank you very much. Was there anybody there or anybody else online scheduled to testify for 323 at this time? Nina Kinney? Also, Stephanie Joannides? Joannides?
My name is Stephanie Joannides. I'm an Assistant Attorney General from the Department of Law. Thank you for this opportunity to comment on Representative Swackhammer's bill. The Department of Law considers this bill to be a very important one. In many child sexual abuse cases and other cases, children have a very difficult time testifying. This bill would enable many children who were traumatized by testimony or who were unable to testify before to actually participate in the court proceeding and allow the prosecution of certain cases to go forward. excuse me. Some examples of cases that could not be prosecuted in the past is a case of a 2.5-year-old young girl who could explain the incident to a prosecutor in an office who was able to barely testify sitting on the floor during a grand jury. But before trial, it was determined this child could not testify in court. In that case, the case had to be ultimately dismissed. In other parts of the state, for example, in Fairbanks, there was a situation where one young boy, age 9, twice broke down on the stand and was unable to testify, though he had been able to proceed through a grand jury. That case had to ultimately be dismissed because the child was unable to provide the court and the jury with the appropriate information. Another incident involved the taking of testimony of a young girl on her mother's lap under the prosecutor's table. And I could go on and on with examples. But for those reasons, we wholeheartedly support the bill and ask for this committee's support also.
Are there any questions? Representative Rieger and Representative Gall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only questions I have with the bill have to do with how the evidence then gets to the jury. And I'm wondering a couple things. First is, can this televised testimony, I assume this is going to be recorded and then replayed. Is that the case, or is it live?
No, Mr. Chairman, the way it would work is that it would go through closed circuit TV. So it would be an actual live presentation. The child would be located in another room, and the jury would be able to view the testimony as it occurred. In certain situations, the court would have the latitude to videotape, and then the presentation would be made to the jury during the trial.
If it were videotaped, could it be edited?
No, it would have to be presented to the jury in the same way as if the testimony was taken live.
Okay. Just a couple of last questions. On the third page, it says only court and counsel may question the child. Does counsel mean the prosecutor and the defense attorney, or is that the
that's
counsel of both sides?
The attorneys for both sides.
Okay, and the last one is just on what goes on. Is there discussion later allowed in the courtroom as to either the defense or the prosecutor elaborate on what was going on in the room when this was recorded in front of the jury? I mean, can they say, well, what you didn't see on the camera was that such and such was going on? I mean, is that type of debate permitted in the courtroom after the fact?
That would be a matter that would be up to the judge's discretion, but I would anticipate that argument would not be allowed because the jury would actually be able to see everything that went on. So, for example, while the child was testifying, the jury would be able to see the child on camera. If there was another individual there as a support person for the child, that person would also have to be on screen to make sure that the jury could see the whole process.
Okay, that's what I was driving at, I guess. So the support person cannot nod his head, say yes to that one, or shake his head and be off camera doing that.
No, and in fact, the prosecutor and the defense attorney would be able to see that, and I can assure you that if this poor person was making any signals to the child, there would be an objection right then and there, and there would be comment.
That's why I asked if it could be brought up later, but I think it's adequately covered. Thank you.
Representative Gall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one moment. I'm sorry, I'm just trying to find the, or viewing the trust system. Where is the language in the bill that says the so-called support person would be on camera?
That is not in the bill
itself.
Why
did you say that that's the fact?
Because that the court was going to have to make certain findings when the actual televised portion of the testimony goes forward. And the court has to follow constitutional precepts. It also has to make sure that the whole process is done in a fair manner.
Fair manner? I don't know what that has to do with having someone else in the room being on camera. You expressed an opinion then that, in your opinion, the court might rule that that was required, right? There's nothing at all on which you base that as an assertion that the person who was in the room would be on camera.
No, that is not specifically in the bill itself. There was discussion about that very issue. And every part, every step of the process is not included in the bill. The court is going to have to make certain rulings. So we didn't go in and put every conceivable situation in the bill, because the bill, if you notice, is a fairly broad bill. It gives the court a lot of discretion to set up situations in different courtrooms. For example, a situation in Anchorage would be much different than one in Bethel, or one in Haines, or one in Sitka, or one in Ketchikan, depending on the locale, the availability of courtroom space, and other methods. The court has to have a lot of discretion in making its decision.
Could you review your testimony before this committee and tell me what other statements you made as statements of fact were, in fact, statements of opinion? Because I was just sort of going along with it, and it sounded real good. And then when the issue came up of whether or not there was, in fact, any reason to believe that the individual in the room with the child would be on camera, you've indicated to me there's no reason to believe that. That, you know, that would be nice if the court rules that way, and obviously a defense attorney is going to request it. But what else have you said that was supposition?
Well, Representative Gall, the state would also request that. And the best of my...
Excuse me, you mean if you were the attorney, the state would request it?
Yes, and the Department of Law would send out guidelines to all district attorneys' offices as the constitutional matters they should follow. The
have
state,
those been drafted?
No, because the bill has not passed yet. The best of my knowledge, I made no other substantive statements about the bill. The discussion or the examples I made to this committee only involved the need of the bill. The only substantive comments I made were in response to
Representative
question.
Questions. I appreciate that, Ms. Johnies. Do you think that given... First of all, let me say I appreciate the work that you've done, and I got some questions about, is the public defender represented here today?
I believe there's a representative of the public defender on teleconference, Mr. Salemi, though I'm not sure if he's...
Is there a representative of... No? I guess my tendency to support the bill is based on my understanding that the public defender's office and the attorney general's office have reached consensus on the language. And can you tell me if that's a correct understanding?
That's correct. Dana Fabe and I have met a number of times on the bill.
No, I'm sorry. Dana Fabe, speaking in her official capacity, is representing the public defender's office, and you, in your official capacity, representing the attorney general's office, have reached before the Judiciary Committee a public agreement on the content of this bill. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay.
Could you share with me, I don't mean to be aggressive in the questioning, I just, you know, I want to see the offenders convicted and jailed. I want to see the rights of the accused protected, and I'm sure you and all of us do as well. But I think Representative Rieger's question is very germane, and it was something that hadn't occurred to me before, and that is the issue of prompting the defendant. And there is a certain logic to imagining that it is appropriate, at least in my mind, appropriate for inclusion in the statute, that if a closed circuit presentation is going to be made, that all persons who are in the room be in fact on camera. It doesn't seem to me, as a layman, that that's something that should be left to speculation as to whether or not the court is going to so rule. I understand that it's your belief that they will. I know some judges whose judgment I don't have that kind of confidence in. So what's your thought about it? I mean, do you think it would be an intrusion on the bill to suggest that that be in the statute itself?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gall, no, I don't think that anybody would have any problem with including that kind of language in the bill. I would again just reiterate my previous comment that the defense attorney will be present and will make an objection right away should anything inappropriate occur.
Would logically make an objection
should
anything
inappropriate. That's correct, to preserve the record. Otherwise, the point couldn't be raised in appeal.
Mr. Chairman, if I might have liberty, I'd just like to ask the sponsor.
Representative Swecker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What occurred in judiciary basically is the foundation for the findings of fact that a judge will review. In other words, the testimony that occurred in judiciary is very important to any litigation and to how the judge is going to look at this piece of legislation for implementation. And Ms. Joannides was basically given that as being part of the bill, the testimony itself. I think it's an assumption by all parties involved that very issue was raised as to someone else prompting the witness and the jury not being able to view that would be a concern, but all the parties were satisfied that the language and the legislative history was well documented in judiciary that was the.
Well, I'll underline, Mr. Chairman, I'll underline that has been the content of the testimony today, and that it would be presumably this committee's expectation that court rules would address it. However, I won't move an amendment, but if Representative Rieger feels it requires something specific, I would support that amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rieger.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be willing to check into it and perhaps offer a floor amendment, because even though it's the intent, I would be more comfortable if it is specific. There could be a practical problem in, I guess, the resolution of the camera. And, 225 lines. You know, you need a close-up if you're going to catch an expression, but you need to be back far enough so you can get the questioner and the supporting person and the witness all together there. But I think it's important enough that I think it's worth taking another look at, and I hope that the members would be amenable to that kind of floor amendment, since it's only an attempt to improve what I think is a good bill anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Representative Rieger taking that approach. It gives me a few days to talk to the other parties involved to talk about those logistical problems and see if that can be worked out, and so I'll be in touch with them.
Other questions of the witness?
I'd just like to conclude my remark by saying, yes, that is certainly satisfactory to me. I appreciate the courtesy of the sponsor and Representative Rieger's research, and I would also point out the context to that inquiry that if technical facilities, that is the existence of cameras, located at the, let's say you're in Haines, where their technical equipment is not that great, and the issue comes up as to whether or not there are enough cameras and enough monitors to provide scrutiny of the people in the room, would be my impression that you can't use this system unless you've got the technical apparatus adequate to do it right. And I'm pleased we had the discussion, and I'll certainly support the joint effort between the two members. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Joannides, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that cares to testify on this bill? What is the desire of the committee, Representative Swackhammer?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I ask for unanimous consent to move committee substitute for House Bill 3. 323 from committee with fiscal note individual recommendations.
Any objection? Not. The CS for Hospital 323 judiciary and the accompanying fiscal note moves from committee. The last bill that we have before us is House Bill 207. This bill will be going into subcommittee consisting of Representative Larson, Chair, and Representative Davis and Rieger. Okay, we're off teleconference again. I don't know if we have anybody signed up for House Bill 207. Representative Davis, did you want to explain the bill?
Yeah.
Are you going to solo here?
Mr. Chairman, we do have somebody from the Permanent Fund.
For a question.
I'm going to have him speak to his letter. I did an attempt to try to decipher it, but I thought it would be best for him to speak to it. But let me just say that, just for openers on this piece of legislation, that I kind of got interested in this topic last year when we had a large sale of stock. I mean, the Permanent Fund had a large sale of stock, and I realized that the realized gains go into the undistributed account of the Permanent Fund. They don't go into the principal. And a lot of large funds, are the way they're managed, they go actually when you have a sale of stock, it goes into the principal of the fund. And actually, that's the way that the Permanent Fund was originally set up, was in 1980. There was a change, but originally, when there was proceeds, it became part of the principal of the fund. And with that, I think I'll just withhold my my remarks, except to say one more thing. I think this would take away some of the incentive that may be to the board to perhaps have a sale to make available large amounts of money that would then be in the undistributed income account. So with that, I think I'll just yield the floor, if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, and let Mr. Kelly speak to the legislation.
Kelly, you want to identify yourself?
Sure. My name is Jim Kelly. I'm the Research and Liaison Officer for the Permanent Fund Corporation. I prepared a memo at the request of Marla, of course, works for the chairman. We thought it might be useful if you took a look at a financial projection that showed what would have happened, what would have been the impact had you had this bill in effect since the inception of the fund, as well as another projection that shows the status quo and a projection that shows 207 from this time forward. She thought it might also be helpful if I started with a discussion of exactly what is a capital gain. And of course, the permanent fund income consists of interest earned on bonds, which isn't a capital gain, dividends that we earn on stocks, which isn't a capital gain, cash flow from the real estate that we own, not a capital gain. A capital gain is when we sell an asset for more than we paid for it. That can happen in stocks, bonds, or real estate. Last year, the $323 million we made was from selling stocks for more than we paid for it. The year before, we had over $300 million in capital gains from selling bonds for more than we paid for them. As of the end of January, we've got capital gains this year, realized capital gains, cash money that we received for those kinds of transactions, totaling about $44 million is all. Unrealized capital gains right now, or as of the end of January anyway, were $364 million. It's unrealized, even though it's worth more than we paid for it, because we haven't sold it. At the time we sell it, it then becomes realized capital gain. This bill is only dealing with realized capital gains. If this bill were in effect right now, at the end of this year, on June 30, the corporation would do its dividend calculation, pay out its $424 million over to the general fund for the dividends. We would do the inflation proofing calculation, and pay over $301 million, just transferred from earnings reserve to principal. And then in addition, we would take the $44 million that we've got in realized capital gains this year, and we would add that to the principal. That last $44 million is what would be different this year if this bill were passed. You would have taken $44 million out of the earnings reserve account and added it to the principal, which wouldn't happen under the status quo. A lot of the discussion in this memo kind of goes into how come in the projection for 207, which is labeled number 2, it doesn't show capital gains in the future. And the reason for that is that you never know when you're going to be able to take capital gains. We had last year and the year before two of the most unprecedented years in the financial markets in U.S. history. Plus $300 million we were able to realize. But if you look at the financial projection number 3, which shows the actual capital gains to date, you can see that those were the only 2 years when there was really any large number of those capital gains. So most of the years we didn't have any at all. Anyway, you just don't know when you're going to get them. It all depends on the market cycles and so forth. But we do assume we're going to earn capital gains in the future. We didn't want to give that impression to you. The trustees have set a goal of trying to earn 3% above the rate of inflation over the long term on average. The only way they're going to be able to accomplish that is if the stock that we invest in does, in fact, pay a lot of capital gains. And the real estate that we buy, we are able to sell it down the road for more than we paid for it. We expect, on average, over the long term, that 3/4 of the money we make for every dollar, for every investment we've got in stocks is going to come from capital gains. We don't really expect to make any money in capital gains in bonds, even though we made 300 a couple of years ago. We don't expect that to happen. That was extraordinary. And we expect half of the money that we make in real estate to come from appreciation, and that would be capital gain. So that 9% earnings rate that we expect for the future sort of does include capital gains on average over the long term. We just can't tell you when it's going to come. So the bottom line is that if you pass the bill, you're going to be adding to the principal of the permanent fund for sure this year. And any year where we have enough money to pay dividends, pay full inflation proofing, and have got capital gains, you will be adding to the principal in that year in excess of what you get under the status quo. But in those years, as we predict, are going to be the standard, not the exception, and we earn 9% with a 6% inflation rate, that won't even be enough to do full inflation proofing and dividends, much less add capital gains to principal. And that's why at the bottom line on projection number 2, the numbers look exactly the same as they do on the status quo. It all depends on the actual performance. Those years where we make the money, it'll add to principal, but in most years we would expect an inflation proofing shortfall, and then there'd be no difference.
Well, Mr. Kelly, what you're saying, inflation proofing is the same as depositing in principal, whether it's from capital gains or any source, right?
Yes. When you established, what happened is, Mike referred to the fact that it used to be done, the capital gains were transferred to principal. But what happened is in 82, the legislature threw that out and decided, well, we're going to fully inflation proof. Whatever the rate of inflation is, we're going to appropriate that from earnings that year. And that is that really is a preferable way, because then you're pretty much sure that you're going to get exactly what you need for inflation proofing, not too little, not too much, is exactly what you need. And in all of America, it's probably the most effective way to protect the principal against the effects of inflation that any fund has. The only risk we have, of course, is that it's second behind dividends, and we might have years, and we project that we'll have years where we won't have the money to do that.
Representative Davis, did you have further comments?
I forgot the exact figure you had. You said that you expect out of 9% growth with 6% inflation, you expect about a 3% real growth in the permanent fund in terms of money. So let's say if you had, $9 billion, then that would be, is that $270 million? Is that what that is, real growth?
Well, this year, for example, we'd be adding $314
million.
That's close.
Okay, $314 million. And did you say one-third of that or two-thirds of that would be from capital gains that you in the future?
Well, this year actually turns out to be $44 million
of the 314.
Yeah, it's those percentages were of the different types of investments. Expect 3/4 of the stock income to be capital gains.
Okay, 3/4 of the stock income, and the stock income.
And stock, of course, is only the asset allocation has the permanent fund investing from 12% to 20% of total assets in stock. Right now, we're close to 12%. So we've got 12% of the money invested in stock. 3/4 of the income that produces, on average over the long term, will come from capital gains.
Hey Jim, what I'm trying to do, and I'm not going to do it. What I'm trying to do is figure out what percentage of the fund would be earned from capital gains. Let's say you said it's 44 this year, but just one third of the gains are going to be in capital gains. Is that a rough figure?
It all depends on the asset allocation. It depends how much money you've got in stocks and how much you've got in real estate. At the present rate, where you've only got, 12% in stocks.
Okay. I'm asking a hypothetical question, and it's too difficult to answer, so I won't push you to that one. But
I don't have the answer to it. Sorry.
I thought you said the not only stocks, but real estate also would be in the capital.
Half of the money that we expect to make in real estate, we expect to come from selling something for more than we paid for it.
What I was trying to determine is just what kind of a estimate you would have that would be in the capital gains column there. You only have, obviously 44 for this year, but just what that means in the future. What kind of additions do you anticipate?
I'd say it was somewhere between 40 and 100 million. Based on the present asset allocation.
Other questions?
That's roughly what I was driving at. Okay, thank you.
Representative Gold?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Trying to get a layman's perspective here. As I read the bill, what you're changing in law is that instead of being responsible to show the total capital gains as income, you're only responsible to show the net capital gains as income. Is that correct?
The bill would include capital gains as part of net income, at least in terms of counting dividends, for example.
I'll try again. Today's law shows capital gains as income,
yes.
But this would show net capital gains as income instead of all capital gains as income. Is that right?
No, that wouldn't change it. Net income would still include capital gains under the bill.
Let me try again. What I'm trying to do is understand what the bill does. I've listened to the discussion. I see in Section 1, it says let me just make sure I have the right substitute here. No, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. Okay. We're working off the state affairs substitute. Is that correct,
right.
Mr.? The following amounts shall be transferred from net income. Is the existing language just relocated,
mm-hmm.
Excluding income on earnings reserve, etc. That's just existing language relocated.
Mm-hmm.
Get down to subsection 2. It says an amount equal to the capital gains that exceed the capital losses. That's new language.
Mm-hmm.
All I can understand is that your capital losses were not previously deducted from your capital gains. You were responsible to show your gross capital gains.
Oh, no. We always net out losses against the gains. Now, in our financial statements, it's always net capital gains.
Could you help me? I'm not very sophisticated in these things. What is the effect of the bill in the simplest possible language then?
It'll add $44 million to the
principal
permanent
sir.
Fund.
I mean, procedurally and structurally, what is that?
We'll do three calculations at the end on June 30 of each year instead of two. Right now, we do dividends and inflation proofing. Under this bill, we would do dividends, inflation proofing, and we would make a note of the capital gains that we took, and we would transfer that if we had sufficient funds to do it.
Transfer that?
From earnings to principal.
So the effect of this bill is to go back to where we were before, where capital gains or net capital gains were returned to the principal of the fund?
No, this would be in addition to it. This would be the way we used to do it, plus it would combine inflation proofing plus taking capital gains. In the beginning, there was no inflation proofing. There was just capital gains.
But with relation to the capital gains, just aside from the inflation
yes.
proofing, this returns us to reinvesting the capital gains
yes.
into the fund.
dandy bill.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your chart three, Jim, mm-hmm. does the fact that there are no capital gains shown in the years 89 forward imply that you don't expect any, or they're just not shown on this chart? I'm not clear about that.
That's what I was trying. I didn't explain that very well. We expect them, and we expect them in those percentages that I mentioned. And they show up in the net income column, but how you would extrapolate them and show them in any given year is beyond our ability. I mean, it's just big guesses. We don't know. I mean, there'll be years when we won't take any capital gains at all, you know, because the market will just be falling. And we won't be selling any real estate. There'll be other years, like there have been, where we take hundreds of millions of dollars. But
bill would remove any incentive for the permanent fund to sell off some stock and put it into the undistributed income account. There wouldn't be any incentive to do that. It wouldn't be setting out there.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, you're right. Money would only be in the earnings reserve account until June 30, and then it would go to principal.
There was a concern last year by some members of the legislature and others that the way the law reads now, there would be an incentive for the permanent fund, and I'm saying they have done that in the past, but that there would be incentive for the permanent fund board to show a large income by selling some of the stock off. That was one of the reasons I got interested in this.
Just a comment, I think.
This has always been my impression that the permanent fund board has been very, very protective of the principal and in favor of putting anything they could into the principal. I don't know how this would, you know, change that philosophy. I would just assume that it would continue what's being done now. May be wrong. That's why I guess we got a subcommittee to find that out.
The trustees would not have an objection to passage of this legislation.
Right, it's something that they've already favored, that any available monies, they always favored going into the principal and to be ordered on it.
Other questions? If not, this bill goes in subcommittee with Larson, Davis, and Leader, and House Finance adjourned.